Please the court, Mr. Benjamin Barlow will argue for appellant, Mr. Christian Tucker will argue for appellee.
Ms. Barlow.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Ben Barlow and I represent Mr. Bill Collins in this appeal, and as the pleadings show in this case, Mr. Collins has filed a lawsuit incredibly against some fraternity officers who had made some trumped up charges and wrongfully took his membership away that he had worked hard and devoted time in a retaliatory effort against him and others for some lawful dissent they had about some actions. But the merits of the claims, the underlying claims in this case, are not before you today. What's before you today is a form selection clause issue where appellees want you to force Mr. Collins to go to the East Coast to pursue claims he ought to pursue, be able to pursue here in Texas. And they want to do this based on a wrongfully approved form selection clause that doesn't even apply to him and that is unenforceable under the Texas law and jurisprudence regarding form selection clauses. I have three issues in my appellant's brief, and I'll probably only be able to get to two of them today, but they're pretty heavily briefed. The first is the form selection clause doesn't even apply to Mr. Collins. The court uses the plain meaning rule regarding this, and using that plain meaning rule, the court will find that he is not within the scope of the form selection clause. But even if the court were to find that he was within the scope, it's not enforceable against him in the facts and circumstances in this case using the analysis adopted by Texas courts and including this court in Luxury Travel versus American Airlines. Finally, and it's briefed in our brief, they had the burden, we believe, under CNOOC to show that they had validly passed the form selection clause at the time that Mr. Collins filed suit. And we believe they didn't carry that burden, and moreover, we believe that we show that it wasn't proved, and the undisputed fact shows that they didn't pass this rule in accordance with their own rules in effect at the time of the conclave. But getting to the first issue of scope, this issue alone, we believe, requires a reversal and remand to the trial court. It's undisputed that Mr. Collins was expelled from this organization in January of 2003, and so he was no longer a member when he filed suit in January of 2004. And the form selection clause, which is cited heavily in our briefs, and the exact language of it, states that the sole venue for any legal proceeding brought by a member shall be in Albemarle County, Virginia, or at any other place that the Supreme Executive Committee of the fraternity so chooses and publishes to the fraternity. And the law that courts apply to rules of an organization is the plain meaning rule when they're interpreting an unambiguous rule. And no one has argued that this is an ambiguous rule. We all agree it's unambiguous. And this rule applies to contracts. We cited Ramsey. It applies to written contracts. It applies to statutes. We've cited Mladenka. And in Mladenka, I actually noticed last night when reading it, I submitted this case to the court with two missing pages, and I'd like to this afternoon send you those pages so that you have the whole case, if that's okay. But in Mladenka, the issue was whether an ex-spouse or a non-spouse fell under the term spouse in a statute, and the court applied the plain meaning rule and said, no, of course not. An ex-spouse is not a spouse. And we argue that a non-member or an ex-member is not a member under this clause. And actually, a case came out after the trial court ruled on this called UNESCI. And we didn't have UNESCI before the trial court, but we cited this court to it, and that involved a member of an organization subject to the rules of the organization. The UNESCI court said you apply the plain meaning rule. And in that case, UNESCI was opposing a form selection clause, and he was a diplomate of the OB-GYN organization. And they had sent out a notice to everyone saying all applicants to become diplomates will be subject to this form selection clause. Well, the court held, applying the plain meaning rule, that he was a diplomate. He had been a diplomate for 20 years, and this form selection clause only applied to those who were applying to become diplomates. So it's almost directly on point, except in our case, it's the flip side. The flip side is that Collins was a member, and now he's no longer a member. But the plain meaning rule applies nevertheless, and so he's not within it. And the lesson to take from UNESCE is that if you're going to hold your members or ex-members or applicants to a form selection clause, you need to be precise in your language. And they just weren't precise in their language here. But the evidence also shows that 2 years later, after Mr. Collins filed his suit, that the fraternity knew how to draft a rule that included non-members or ex-members. And what they did is they amended the rule and changed the rule 3.5 and added that initiates who resign or otherwise are no longer members are subject to this rule. Well, that was after Mr. Collins had already filed his suit. So we would argue that their amendment later doesn't apply to him.
Mr. Barlow, under your yes. analysis, though, wouldn't that mean, for example, that someone who was an employee with a corporation and had an employment agreement and then perhaps was wrongfully terminated, they're no longer an employee as probably defined in that document, but they have rights under that contract or agreement?
Well, if the party was a signatory to a contract and he agreed up front and saw the forum selection clause before he signed up for it, I believe it would apply to him, because if it was, he would be defined as the employee as a party to the agreement. In this case, we don't have that. We don't have a signatory. We have an organization drafting it without any input from anyone else, and they've defined it. There's no ability for Mr. Collins to come in and say and negotiate. So I think there's a distinction there. That employee, by signing it, obviously would be subject to that agreement and whatever the terms they are, and you'd have to interpret those terms according to the plain meaning.
Was there any evidence submitted as to what constitutes, later membership in the organization, you know, as an alum?
I'm not following your question.
Well, in other words, is somebody who's a former collegiate member, say, for example, are they automatically forever a member of the organization? Or is there something they have to do subsequent to their collegiate days to remain a member?
You mean after someone pledges a fraternity?
Right.
No, they're an alumni member. They're still a member.
Okay.
But we did put evidence on, and I think it's undisputed, that as of January 18th of 2003, he was no longer a member.
Okay.
And I think that's undisputed.
Well, if I understand what you're saying, it's that as of the date of his lawsuit, yes, he's seeking certain benefits under this contract agreement document, but under that document, there was no forum selection clause that applied to him.
Well, I think it's a little bit different than that. I think our argument is, and we agree, that rules and bylaws of an organization are interpreted as a contract. But just like any other contract, they're subject to legal limits. You can't put in a indemnification against your own negligence in there unless it complies with the express negligence doctrine. So we're saying, yes, you treat this as a contract, but you apply the law to the contract. And one of the laws you apply is the form selection clause analysis as well as the plain meaning rule. So you do treat it as a contract. It's not just because you become a member doesn't mean that the organization gets to make any rules it wants, whether they comply with the law or not.
But I thought you said as of 2003, forum selection clause did not apply to Mr. Collins because it didn't have that language about ex-members or however it's raised.
That is correct.
Right. So that your position is, yes, he's seeking benefits under the contract, but the contract didn't have a forum selection clause that applied to him at the time he filed suit.
I don't know that he's seeking benefits under the contract. He is.
Well, isn't he wanting back in the organization, which is governed by the contract?
Actually, technically, he's seeking an injunction that says they can't enforce the expulsion order, as well as he's got a defamation claim and a breach of fiduciary duty claim.
So he's not seeking benefits under the contract?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, he hadn't filed a breach of contract claim. He is seeking an injunction, which I believe he's allowed to do under the exceptions to the non-intervention doctrine, that sometimes courts do intervene in these types of decisions, and they do use injunctive relief as part of the remedy.
Maybe we should just remember what Groucho Marx said, which was, I would belong to a club that had me as a member.
But to further go on your point, Your Honor, the appellee's only argument to this point is essentially Mr. Collins is bound by all rules that we make just because he's a member, and that he's waived and stopped from making or from challenging a forum selection clause because he became a member. And we address this point in our appellate brief at 2E, page 13 and 15, and we believe that this issue was fairly included as a subsidiary question. We've also submitted to this court a motion to deem this issue fairly included, the waiver and estoppel issue, as well as a motion to supplement, which we've included in reply point 9 and would request the court to rule on that. But the primary case they rely on to make this point is the Ubinus Brash case, and they cite a lot of quotes from page 42 of that case, which deal with the non-intervention doctrine that I'm talking about, which says, you know, generally courts aren't going to interfere in the decisions of organizations, but if they act arbitrarily, capriciously, if they try to legislate through an interpretation, which I believe is happening here, trying to say that member equals non-member, up means down, well, then the courts will intervene. But that issue isn't before the court. The real issue in Ubinus Branch and the law is on page 41 of that case. And what that says is that an organization like this fraternity has the power, and a member by joining agrees to it, has the power to administer and make its rules within the legal limits. And a lot of the cases cited either phrase that as within legal limits, lawfully, and they phrase it that way, which means that you've got, you know, Bill Collins can't come in here and challenge the raising of his dues, but he could come in and challenge a forum selection clause or an indemnification clause that didn't comply with Texas law, a DTPA waiver that's unconscionable under Texas law, or something that, you know, forces him to commit a crime. Any of those things that are unconscionable, this organization doesn't have the power to make those rules because they're not within legal limits. And the same thing applies to a forum selection clause. It doesn't get, just the fact that become a member doesn't give the organization carte blanche to negate Texas law, and that's what our argument is, and I don't believe that appellees have addressed that. Moving on to the enforceability question, the court should not enforce a forum selection clause against Mr. Collins that was purportedly passed 40 years after he became a member because enforcement will go against just about every factor and rationale that this court and other Texas courts have used in determining enforceability of forum selection clause. There was no upfront bargain agreeing to where they would have a dispute like there was in Bremen. There was no arm's length transaction like there was in Bremen. There was no signed agreement, even if he didn't look at it. There was no signed agreement between him and the fraternity with a forum selection clause. He wasn't required, like in the Barnett case I cited, to go through and look at it, even though if he didn't, and check a box saying he reviewed it. There was no actual notice of the forum selection by email, like there was in the Luxury Travel American Airlines case. There was no actual notice at all. The affidavit of Bill Collins regarding notice is undisputed, and the testimony of the executive director, Mr. Wilson, admits that Mr. Collins never got notice of this. All they say is, we posted it on our website. Well, and that really is the heart of this enforceability issue, is that the fundamental fairness test adopted by this court in Luxury Travel, two of the factors in that test say the person's got to have adequate notice, not constructive notice, adequate notice of the forum selection clause with the opportunity to reject that clause with impunity, meaning without penalty or without harm. Like I said, those are two of the three factors adopted by this court in Luxury Travel, and actually this panel in Luxury Travel. And what they try to argue is he got constructive notice. We put it up on our website, password protected, to get to it. But they didn't do what they did in Luxury Travel, which is send an email to the person subject to it and provide evidence that, yes, they received it. Here's our email list, and it shows that they got it. And as well as in American Airlines, the party opposing the forum selection clause had a prior agreement with the forum selection clause in the ARC agreement at issue in that case. And so they had adequate notice. They had actual notice. And constructive notice is not the correct standard, and that's what they're relying on. It's adequate notice. And constructive notice is a concept that replaces actual notice. You know, you file in the deed records. You don't have to actually notice them. They are on constructive notice. That's not a concept that's applicable in this case.
Excuse me. Was there a forum selection clause at the time he filed his lawsuit?
No. Well, there was one in there at the time he filed his lawsuit, but it only applied to members. But we also argue in our third point that it wasn't in effect because they didn't pass it in accordance to their rules.
And was he claiming to not expel him, or that they had expelled him, but it was wrongful?
That his claim is they wrongfully expelled him. He was definitely not a member, but he was seeking to enjoin that, enjoin the enforcement of that order that kicked him out of the organization. And I believe my time.
So, to beat this critically conditioned horse one more time, your position is, number one, at the time the suit was filed, the plain meaning rule only, we apply that, it only applied to members, and he was no longer a member. And if you look at the language of the amended forum selection clause about members or those that are no longer members, whatever it says, that was passed after his lawsuit was
Correct.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow. Mr. Tucker.
May it please the court, Christian Tucker for the Appalachians, Kappa Sigma Fraternity, and Phil Thames. Your Honor, I basically would like to address as a threshold matter, or Your Honors, as a threshold matter, the standard review in this case. The appellant takes the position that everything is a de novo review. While that may be true as it relates to the interpretation of an unambiguous contract, such as the form selection clause in this case, or as it relates to undisputed facts, it doesn't apply to situations where you have disputed facts, and under that standard, it's an abuse of discretion review. The cases that stand for that proposition are there's a litany of them, but it's Deepwater Slender Wells, Phoenix Network Technologies, Flying Diamond, Satterwhite Aviation. All of these stand for the proposition that abuse of discretion standard review is the proper one when dealing with a court's granting of a motion to dismiss based on a forum selection clause. The findings in this case that should be subject to an abuse of discretion standard are those relating to waiver, estoppel, and a quasi-estoppel. Your Honor, in this case, as the appellant pointed out, Mr. Barlow, they take the position that it's undisputed that Mr. Collins had notice of the form selection clause. That's not the finding of the underlying trial court. The underlying trial court found that Mr. Collins had a constructive, if not actual, notice of the form selection clause based on the fact that he was a member when it became a part of the 2001 CBR. And the only evidence that the appellant has submitted in support of the fact that Mr. Collins didn't have actual notice was the testimony of Mr. Collins. The testimony of Mr. Kent, who was the appellant's witness at the evidentiary hearing in this matter, Ernie Kent, a disgruntled former Kappa Sigma member, he himself admitted that the 2001 CBR was readily available either on the website or at... Under the case law, Your Honor, it's a
case that says available on the password protected website is adequate notice.
Well, the cases that indicate that, Your Honor, in this case, there are no cases on point that deal with organizational bylaws. but as we know, when Mr. Collins became a member of Kappa Sigma Fraternity, he bound himself to the Constitution, bylaws, and rules of Kappa Sigma Fraternity, and any changes to those Constitution, bylaws, and rules that were done within legal limits. In this case,
we're going down a rabbit trail now. We're talking about notice, not binding himself to what they were.
Correct, Your Honor.
Let's go back to notice. Is your position, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm just asking you, is it your position that the password-protected website is adequate notice of the change in the bylaws?
Your Honor, yes, I do. Especially when the individual is a member in good standing and has a password to access it. any member in good standing doesn't have to get on the website. They can call the headquarters and get a copy. Actually, it's in the record that CBRs go out to any volunteer officer, which included Mr. Kent in the past. They also go to every undergraduate chapter. You have to keep in mind that the Kappa Sigma fraternity has over 170,000 members, undergraduate and alumni. So you're talking about killing a heck of a lot of trees if you wanted to mail out a CBR to 170,000 people. They send them out to the chapters, they send them out to the voluntary officers, and they make it readily accessible to those that would like a copy. And I think it's clear that the law is that the contract and the appellants conceded that the Constitution, bylaws, and rules constitute a contract between the member when they join and the organization. More on the abuse of discretion standard, Your Honors. Also the issue of whether or not the Forum Selection Clause was validly passed. The trial court decided this issue in appellee's favor. If you look at the briefings, you'll see that the appellees, we presented the deposition testimony, which was not objected to by the appellant, of Mr. Mick Wilson, the executive director of Kappa Sigma Fraternity, also his affidavit testimony, and also the testimony of Mr. Kent, their own witness, confirms that the Forum Selection Clause was validly passed. And to the extent that the appellant disputes that, the court's ruling in that regard is subject to an abuse of discretion standard of review. Following up with whether or not the Forum Selection Clause applies to Mr. Collins specifically, none of the cases cited, excuse me.
Let's just start with the Forum Selection Clause as it stood at the time the lawsuit was filed. Does it say it applied to members, and that's all it says?
Well, it says more than members. It says chapters and related entities, but correct. You're correct. It does not say members and ex-members.
All right.
You're correct.
That occurred subsequent to the filing of the lawsuit, the amendment.
In 2005, it was amended, and not that particular provision, mind you, not 3.5.4. It was not amended to say members and ex-members. Another provision in the subpart of Rule 3.5 was amended to clarify that it applies to initiates. The rule itself, the Forum Selection Clause itself, remained the same.
Okay.
It still said member.
Okay.
And Your Honor, we've cited cases that point to the fact that Dallas County Medical Society and Gibson versus Boy Scouts of America, which is a Virginia case, that the CBRs, the constitutions of these private organizations, still bind a member when he is expelled. This is especially true when you have a situation where the underlying lawsuit, Mr. Collins, the entire point of his underlying lawsuit is to get reinstated as a member and to invalidate the very procedures which expelled him as a member. The appellant's counsel referred to UNESCO and Ladanka as supporting a position that Mr. Collins falls outside the scope. Both those cases are readily distinguishable.
So if he amended his lawsuit and dispensed with the injunction, would that affect your argument?
No, I think he's still complaining about about Kappa Sigma Fraternity not following its own procedures.
I thought he was talking about defamation.
That happened during the expulsion process, according to him.
Okay. When he was going to be a member again, let's say. Does that affect your argument, or are you hanging your hat on the fact that he wants to be back in the fraternity, and so you kind of can't have your cake and eat it too?
I think it arises out of the Forum Selection Clause under its plain meaning. I believe the way it's...
Member. He's an ex-member.
Right.
If you thought that was you, every time I thought that
right.
If your client thought that was a problem, what wasn't a problem, why did they amend the wording to specifically set out ex-member?
I believe, Your Honor, maybe I misspoke earlier, but they didn't change it to refer to it.
They amended another clause to make it obvious that member included ex-members.
All right. So if there's a clarification of the rule, then that somehow invalidates the fact that it should apply to ex-members as well? That I don't agree with that, Your Honor, based on the fact that when he joined the fraternity, he agreed to be bound by the CBR. And now he wants to be back in the fraternity, and now he wants to complain about things that happened within the fraternity, and the clause was passed while he was a member, and he should be bound by it.
Not a member, for instance, you can't make him pay dues. But if he's not a member, you can't make him file a suit where you want him to file under the Forum Selection Clause.
I don't think that's at all an inconsistency, Your Honor, given the nature of why the Forum Selection Clause exists in the first place. It's not if, I mean, it applies to membership disputes. And this is what this, I mean, this is a membership dispute.
So the Forum Selection Clause is the purpose of settling membership disputes?
That's what it relates to. It's disputes that arise out of membership in the fraternity.
Okay.
In any event, that's what this case is.
It seems to me that there's a distinction between if he voluntarily withdraws or resigns or whatever the proper word is, and then he sues you. Okay, like he's taking advantage of the words in the Forum Selection Clause, aha, I'm not a member, now I can sue you,
right,
versus you terminating his membership. It seems to me there's a distinction there between him taking an action to get around the Forum Selection Clause and you taking an action and still making him sue you under the Forum Selection Clause.
Well, I think you can harmonize that by the fact that if you have a resignation, then you wouldn't have the issue of waiver, estoppel, and quasi-estoppel. We have a situation here where he wants to be a member. He wants his benefits under the CBR. But at the same time, he doesn't want that particular provision to bind him. So if he resigns and doesn't want to be a member anymore, then you don't have that inconsistency that we have here where he has been expelled and he wants to get back in. I hope that makes sense.
Okay.
As far as the UNESCO case goes, if you'll notice in the UNESCO case, the member in that case, the diplomate, at no time fell within the scope of the Forum Selection Clause in that case. In this case, Mr. Collins was a member when the Forum Selection Clause was passed and bound him as a member. That's I think the most important distinction between this case and UNESCO.
Was the Forum Selection Clause passed before or after he was expelled?
The Forum Selection Clause became a part of the 2001 CBR. He was expelled in January of 2003. It was in existence for over a year before he was expelled.
But it applied to members.
It's always said member, okay, among others, but it doesn't say ex-member, as Justice McCoy pointed out.
All right. And so if a parent of a member who had never been a member chose to sue Kappa Sig for, let's say, physically injuring their child, their 17-year-old child, in hazing, are those parents who have never been a member bound by your Forum Selection Clause?
I don't believe they would be bound by it. Now, the member that was hazed, if he filed a lawsuit individually, I think he would be bound by it.
And so, if a person has been expelled and the clause has not been rewritten to include former members, is that person bound by the Forum Selection Clause, or is that person in the position of the parent who's never been a member?
Well, if a person is expelled, it's our position, such as in this case, that they're still bound by the Forum Selection Clause because of the case law that indicates that an expelled member is still bound by the constitution of the organization, as well as based on the doctrines of waiver, estoppel, and quasi-estoppel, which apply here because of the very nature of the relief sought by the appellant, Mr. Collins.
So it's the nature of the relief that makes him bound by it, not the wording?
That's what makes him bound under the doctrines of waiver, estoppel, and quasi-estoppel, in my view.
Is it your position that you could sue Mr. Collins in Virginia under the Forum Selection Clause as a non-member?
I don't think, obviously.
So
Can't imagine why we would sue Mr. Collins in Virginia as a non-member. If it was a dispute arising out of membership, did Mr. Collins subject himself to jurisdiction in Virginia? I haven't really thought about that. I have to look at the exact wording of the clause again, but I think that if it's a membership dispute, all membership disputes should go to Virginia, where the headquarters is. Another point that was made by Mr. Barlow dealt with issue two, which is whether or not the forum selection clause itself was unenforceable under the fundamental fairness test. And as you know from the briefs, our position is, as a threshold matter, that the fundamental fairness test does not apply in this case. And even if it does, the forum selection clause in this case still meets it. The cases that dealt with fundamental fairness, and I'm cognizant of luxury travel, all of those are distinguishable from this case. They're all commercial cases that deal with fundamental fairness. This is a case of, I think, first impression in this court for sure, where you have a non-commercial context, a forum selection clause placed in a private organization's bylaws and rules. So I think that distinguishes that case, this case, and the cases that that we've cited from other jurisdictions that actually are bylaws cases. Those all indicate that, just like any other rule, forum selection clauses that are contained in bylaws and rules bind the member when they join. May I briefly conclude?
Yes, just wrap up your thought there, please.
It's our position that Mr. Collins had the burden of proof in this case to show the forum selection clause was invalid. We've cited the cases that say that. We've shown he's bound by the forum selection clause by virtue of the contract that exists between him as a member. The CBR is a contract. It was his burden of proof to invalidate it. He did not carry that heavy burden to invalidate it. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Tucker. Mr. Barlow.
Yes, Your Honors. Briefly, Mr. Tucker had mentioned that American Airlines was a commercial case. Well, all these form selection clauses cases have different facts, and this is just another case with different facts. In fact, UNESCO was a bylaws case, and it came out after we had submitted this to the trial court. In UNESCO, they didn't get to the issue of the fundamental fairness test because they ruled that he was beyond scope, but they were going to apply that, and I think this court applies the fundamental fairness test and should apply it here, and there's been no facts showing that Mr. Collins got adequate notice, let alone actual notice. In fact, it's undisputed he didn't get actual notice, and the record will show that. And certainly no opportunity to reject this forum selection clause with impunity. As far as the standard review for the issues before this court, I agree with Mr. Tucker that when you're interpreting this forum selection clause, that's de novo. And when there's undisputed facts related to a legal issue, such as waiver or estoppel or any other issues in here, that's de novo. There may be some disputed facts in the case, but not in anything we presented this court in our briefs. We're relying on undisputed facts in our briefs on these point on our three points. And briefly, I'd like to address the waiver and estoppel issues. Mr. Collins is not seeking to get rid of the entire CBR or saying the entire CBR is unenforceable. All he is arguing is what the law is, that this form selection clause is unenforceable under the fundamental fairness test, and that it doesn't apply to him under the plain meaning rule. That is not a inconsistent position he has taken before. He didn't have notice of it. He never took a position with it until this lawsuit, and it's always been consistent in this lawsuit. That is not a false representation made to Kappa Sig. That is not a knowing relinquishment or an intentional relinquishment of a known right. It's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, their arguments for estoppel and waiver. All he's doing is asserting that this forum selection clause doesn't apply to him, and it's not enforceable under Texas law. And to sum up, no Texas appellate court has ever sent a Texas citizen off to another state based on a forum selection clause where there was no upfront agreement, where they had agreed on the forum in advance, there was no signed contract, no arm's length transaction. A party never got notice of the forum selection clause before the fact, much less after the fact. The person never read it, never saw it. never checked a box showing they had read it, never got a letter saying, come look at our website, we've changed the rules, never get any notice, put on notice to know that there's a rules change, and where the clause didn't even apply to the person in the first place. And under the facts of this case, those are the facts. And it's one of those cases that is on this end of unenforceability. I did not see a case in reviewing all this that didn't have all these factors weighing for unenforceability. And if this court were to uphold the trial court's dismissal and force Mr. Collins to pursue his claims in Virginia based on the facts in this case, then I don't believe any Texan will be safe from an unjust or unreasonable or fundamentally unfair form selection clause, and we request that this court reverse the trial court's decision and remand it so that Bill Collins can pursue his claims in Texas. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Barlow. Thank you, Mr. Tucker. We appreciate your arguments today. We appreciate your briefing, and your case is submitted. You all are excused.